My name is Carolyn Kayo. I am 39 years old. Today is October 3rd, 2007. We are in Baltimore, Maryland. And my relationship to my interview partner here is professional colleague in the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society.
I am Allison Vredenberg. I am 45. And today's date is October 3rd, 2007. I'm in Baltimore, Maryland, and I am interviewing my colleague today through the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society.
So, Allison, do you remember how we first met?
Yes, I do.
How?
We were... We were at a meeting for the leadership of the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society called the Council of Technical Groups. You and I were each chairs of two different organizations, and representing our organizations at this group, I brought up that my group, which is the Forensics Professional Group, was interested in running a mock trial, and we were interested in doing it concerning the a medical device. And you were the chair of the medical group, and
right.
So we together agreed that that would be a good project for our two organizations to work on.
Yeah, I remember the healthcare technical group was called the medical devices group, and I remember you had the idea of looking at how a medical device could be used to teach and show people about human factors design principles. That was a great idea. And in fact, we're doing it in 2 days here at this meeting, right?
Yes, it is. It'll be a good opportunity for people to learn what can go wrong if human factors professionals are not involved in the design of medical products and how important it is to consider the user, since we're all humans and we make all sorts of mistakes every day. If we don't take our many limitations into account when we're designing products, and especially in high stress situations such as a medical environment, then they're going to be prone to error, and you're going to have a lot of injuries and deaths that wouldn't occur if we had gotten involved early on.
Right, and I know that you're involved in a lot of cases. You act as an expert witness, correct?
Yeah, sometimes I'm asked by attorneys if I would explain to the opposing attorneys, sometimes to insurance companies, and very rarely to juries, about the field of human factors, how the design of a product or an environment is affected by our many limitations and our capabilities, and explain how an accident happened and why the particular design as it was really a causal factor because the human user was not taken into account.
I think what you do is fascinating, especially when it comes to, you know, litigation in the courtroom. How did you get into this area?
Actually, in a very strange way, because when I got into it, I didn't even know what it was. I had just moved down to San Diego. I was getting my teaching credential and bought a new house and was having a housewarming party.
Wait, this is after you got your PhD?
No, before.
No,
I had
before.
I went to graduate school twice.
Okay.
So this is after my first time that I went to graduate school and thought I was done. And I had a degree from USC at that time, a master's degree. And so I threw this housewarming party, and someone said, "Can I bring a friend?" And I said, "Sure, bring anyone you want." And this woman comes to the party, and she just casually mentioned, "What do you want to do with your life? What are you going to do now that you're down in San Diego?" And I said, "Well, my dream job doesn't exist." And she said, "Well, what's your dream job?" And I said, "Well, I want a job where I can use all my education, and I can work when I don't want to work, when I want to, and have time off if I want to, have a lot of freedom and control over the job, and where I can learn new things all the time." And she said, "I have the perfect job for you." And I said, "Yeah, right." And you're thinking, okay, cocktail party talk, and I pretty much forgot about it. And then the next day I get a call from her, and she said, "They're interested in you. Send a resume."
Oh.
And I said, "For what?" And she said, "For your dream job."
Wow.
And I said, "What are you talking about? What dream job?" And she says, "With this firm, just mail your resume to this address." So I mailed
What kind of firm was it?
It was a firm that did what's called forensics, which is the application of science to law.
Okay.
And the science involved would be human factors and ergonomics and safety. And so they do investigations and write reports and explain these factors of how accidents occurred to attorneys. And so, but at that time, I didn't know what that was. It was just, as far as I knew, I was just applying to my dream job. So I mailed off this resume to this company that I had no idea what the job was. And I got a call 2 days later, and they said, we want you to come in for an interview. And I still, again, had no clue what I was being interviewed for. So I went and did this interview. And they were apparently looking for the degree at from USC that I had. And they were looking for somebody with an aerospace background, which I also had. And so, and the person from the party knew that I had those things in my background. And so they offered me this job on the spot. And again, I didn't understand the job. And so they tried to explain to me what it was, but I really, it was very abstract to me, and I couldn't, I didn't even know what an expert witness was. I didn't know what forensics was. And it was, it sounded really interesting, but I wasn't quite sure.
Okay.
And so I said, well, I want to finish my teaching credential, and I'll work for you part-time, because I had planned to teach. And then...
what were you planning to teach?
Social studies. My credential is in social studies.
And did you ever do that?
I did my student teaching, and I also consulted with that firm, and I loved it. And so I finished my credential. I've never taught. And, and I ended up working for that firm. And I was there from 1990 through 1997, and then I started my own firm.
Oh, wow.
And I finished my PhD the same year. And
the same year that you started your own firm.
That year, I had a daughter. I finished my PhD and I started my own firm.
Wow. Now, most people would, after finishing their PhD, would go into academe. Well, most people in my area or within my circle. How come you didn't decide to go into academe?
Because I was enjoying the consulting so much. I liked the freedom of being able to have so much control over what jobs I took. And especially when I was able to start my own company where I had total control over that. The variety of work is amazing. I get paid to learn every day. I get to do fascinating things from flying an airplane to driving heavy machinery to going into factories all over the country and looking at all sorts of interesting equipment. I've watched surgery. I have done just so many amazing things with this career. I can't imagine doing anything different. I'm so happy with how that worked out.
Wow. That's great. So if you could do anything now, what would you do? And why?
What would I do now?
If you could do anything.
Wow, I feel like I'm doing it.
Oh.
I'm, what more? I
That's
guess just
a great place to be.
I'm very happy.
Okay.
Perhaps just a new, we're just finishing a big research project and maybe more medical research. I just spoke to somebody about possibly doing some research on teenage driving behavior, and he had some kind of tests to give them, like a profiling, a psychological profile, looking at its correlation to future accidents. If there are certain types of attitudes that might correlate in some way that, that people could be tested ahead of time to prevent incidents later.
Wow. A big, wide range of different topics. So do you have favorite stories from your work?
Favorite stories, I think...
I bet you have tons.
Wow. Well, probably the best job I ever had was when a client picked me up on his private plane. Let me. He had a trainer plane. He let me fly the plane to Vegas.
Wow. Had you flown before?
I've never. Oh. Actually, I'm afraid of, I have a fear of flying, so it was really interesting. And then once we were in Vegas, he then, of course, we stayed at a nice hotel, and then he picked me up in a limo and drove me out to this accident site where I was looking at some heavy machinery. And then I got to play with the heavy machinery. Then I took the limo back to my hotel. They wined and dined me. Oh, and I forgot to tell you, he flew my husband out too.
Oh, nice.
And then he took us to a show, and then he flew it. He let me fly us back.
Wow.
And I got paid for it all.
Oh, nice job. I like your job. Although I couldn't do it.
Why couldn't you do it?
I think it requires a certain personality, and obviously the training is critical, but I think for your job it requires a certain personality to do well, because you have to be on the stand a lot of times, right? And
actually, that's what a lot of people believe, that I spend a lot of time on the stand. I had one trial this year.
Oh.
I had one trial last year.
Uh-huh.
I'm in deposition all the time. I write lots of reports, but if everybody's doing their job really well, they take the deposition information and then reports, and they can settle their case.
And then there's no need to go to trial.
Right, exactly. So my job is really not testifying in court. That's such a tiny part of it.
Really?
It's really informing all the parties so that we don't go to court.
Okay.
Because court's very expensive and very stressful, and nobody really wants to go there.
Mm, I see. So a lot of research, a lot of writing.
A lot of research, which is the fun part.
Yeah.
You get to review things.
I agree.
And you get to play with really cool things. Mm-hmm. I also have done consulting for various airlines, and I get to go out on the ramp and look at all the equipment.
Okay.
Or go into factories, and I get to play with all this heavy machinery. As I say, people in my firm get very dirty. We have a whole black wardrobe.
Oh.
We're very hands-on.
And dirt shows up on black. Well, dust shows up on
it
black.
Does. And we worked for a newspaper for a year consulting with them.
Oh, okay.
And you get toner on everything.
Yeah.
And you go, you just get covered with black. And
I used to work for Xerox as a student.
And so we pretty much got covered. So we had all full black wardrobes that we wore every day to work.
Okay. Chic. On the East Coast, that's what we call it.
A little dark for California.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, I know. I want to ask you. So who has been the most supportive person in your professional life?
Professionally, I've had a couple people that I call my mentors or even sometimes my godfathers.
Mm.
And these are two former presidents of the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society. They are very busy, very well-known, extremely well-liked. Hal Hendrick and Richard Hornick, who I believe are also being interviewed for this series.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them are so hugely generous with their time. And when I have a problem at work, something I'm not sure how I want to handle, or I haven't had the experience, or just want advice, I know I could call either one of them and get advice on and their opinions. I know I'll get complete honesty from both of them about what I should do and how to go about it. And both of them have helped me a lot in my career. As far as getting started in society, I had so many people. They're very welcoming. Mm-hmm. When I started here, pretty much by my second year here, people were nominating me for leadership positions and inviting me to join various organizations and boards. And I just felt like it was so easy to get to know people in a very welcoming organization. And very easy to advance.
I think HFES is a very kind and supportive organization. Yeah, I can see how that happened. So what are the most important lessons you've learned through your work?
Wow. Well, according to my children, what I take home from work is that, mom's a safety freak.
Oh.
I have seen every horrible
thing. Bubble wrap all over your furniture.
Yeah, they wear helmets everywhere. Because I've seen so many horrible things happening to children and to adults, I know what can happen if they don't take certain self-protective behaviors.
Mm.
And so I'm saying, well, you can't do that because this will happen, and you need to wear seatbelts, and you need to wear your helmets, and you need to do this and that, and you can't. And I'm telling my daughter, she's the junior lifeguards over the summer, and people are carpooling and cramming all these children into these cars.
Oh.
And I said, well, when you're in the car, you have to sit in the back seat with a belt on. And so I heard the parents were saying, oh, she's a safety freak. Her daughter has to sit in this particular seat. And I know I was making them wear the helmets. But the good news is I've heard my kids tell their friends, oh, we need eye protection when we're using this. And so it is carrying down, and there is some impact of my work.
Mm.
And as my kids are getting older, I'm involving them in the research. And so they're getting a chance to conduct the research and learn firsthand about a lot of the factors that cause accidents. And
oh, yeah, that's important.
Them.
That's great. Excellent. Good. What other questions do I have? Oh, this is a good one. How has your career been different than what you imagined?
Well, when I was young, I thought I was going to be a lawyer. And then when I was, at one point, I thought I was going to be a doctor. I was started as a pre-med, as an undergrad, and worked as a medical aide at a clinic. And this was around 1983 or so. And as I was interviewing, I interviewed every single MD I came across. Mm. And I said, should I go to med school? Is this the right path to take? They were unanimous. They all said, no, don't go into medicine. There wasn't one person that thought I should go into medicine. And the primary reason was there's this evil, horrible thing coming called managed care.
Oh.
And it was going to ruin medicine for medical doctors and don't go into medicine. And I believed them. They, they sounded very sincere and very convincing.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I was working as a medical aide at the time, and we were drawing blood and doing various things. And HIV was very new. Nobody knew what it was. And there was a lot of fear at the time, not knowing if we could catch it or how we could catch it. And it just seemed as though, and it was, so then we stopped. They wouldn't allow the aides to do a lot of the things we used to do. And I just decided to change majors. And I thought that I could still stay within medicine and work in industrial psychology, which is where I got my degrees. And then, as I told you, I was going to be a teacher. And I went ahead and I was getting my credential and then kind of fell into working in the area of consulting and forensics by accident. So it was quite different than as my plans evolved, they changed. I pretty much made 90-degree turns all along the way and somehow ended up here.
Okay. You know, I think a lot of people in human factors didn't intend to go into human factors. Well, probably because it didn't exist then. But a lot of people ended up in human factors through very convoluted paths. I think it's great. That's how I got it. I got here.
Yeah, I think that it's a great variety of areas that we can work and
still
be in human factors.
It's a huge umbrella. I think it covers so many different areas. You can do pretty much anything you want. You know, I think we've asked a lot of the questions. Oh, here's a question for you. How has being a parent changed you?
Being a parent has had actually a big impact on my career. A lot of what we do can be very intimidating, and especially when you're being cross-examined by a room full of attorneys. However, I'm a parent of two adolescents, and having them go through that, two bright adolescents can spend a lot of time challenging you and cross-examining you. And being able to make my point with them makes it much easier to be effective in my job, as though they're giving me some on-the-job training.
Wow, that's amazing. I never thought that would cross into your professional life, but I think that's great. Are you still friends with anyone from... Wait, what am I asking you here? So let's talk about your life in school. What are your best memories of school? We can start, you know, as far back as grade school, if you want.
Actually, I wasn't really into school until I got to college.
Really? Were you a good student?
It depends on how you define good.
Yeah.
I got good grades, but I would consider myself a really bad student because I just wasn't interested or motivated until I got to college.
Oh,
and
wow.
That tended to change.
How did that change, or why did that change?
I guess so you were more rewarded for intellect instead of criticized for it.
Okay.
And there's more, everybody there pretty much was interested in being at school and learning. It was more of a learning environment.
Right.
And so it was just much more interesting. The classes were more interesting and the opportunities were much better in college.
Did you also make different kinds of friends? I mean, if you think that everyone there being, you know, more motivated and more focused, did some of your friends help you stay focused?
Well, actually, in graduate school, I had the opportunity to meet some amazing people, one of whom, Eileen Zakowitz, is now my associate. She and I started grad school together. I went back much later, and she went straight through, so she's quite a bit younger than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I identified her as one of the sharpest people in the program because she was challenging professors, some of them that were quite intimidating to other students. She showed no fear. She was able to challenge them and about what they were talking about in a way that was humorous, challenging, but non-offensive. And sometimes I often made the professor smile, and I was thinking that would be the perfect person for the firm. At the time, I was vice president of another consulting firm, and I was running the internship program, so I thought she'd be a really good intern. And then when she finally got to the point where we did our internships, she did apply. Without me even mentioning it to her, she applied to be my intern. And so I did hire her, and that was back in about 95 or so, and we're now in 2007. I took her with me when I started my own firm.
So you took her under your wings and...
Yeah, I took her under my wing at the old firm, and then I took her with me when I started my own firm. And she's been with me ever since, and she's here at the conference with me now.
Excellent. Are there other people from that part, that period of your life that you're still friends with?
Yes, we have some other friends that we made, and a professor that we had, our favorite professor, who did a research project with us over the summer. I was the lead investigator of a big project concerning wheelchair accessibility, and I hired him to be my third interviewer.
Oh, wow.
My associate Eileen, who was the student. So basically, the professor and two of his students were the three interviewers for this project, and we tested quite a few people during a one-week period. It was a great opportunity for the three of us to work back together again.
That's interesting, the student hiring the professor.
It was really awkward at first.
I bet.
Having him, it's like, okay, what do we call you? You know, he was always Dr. Sorensen to us when we were the students. And all.
Well, now you're the boss.
Now we're all doctors, and I'm the boss. And so it was a little weird at first, and we even said, what should we call you? And so it took maybe a half day.
Okay.
And then it seemed very normal.
Okay. That's interesting. You know, I think past, well, even in grad school, most people, even students and professors, they become colleagues. So a lot of times they're on first name basis. And obviously after you graduate, you should be all equal colleagues, I think.
For the most part, it's great. Yeah. And we see a lot of them here at conferences.
Yeah.
And it really, the relationships do change and may collaborate on research later. And it's really great when you do recognize each other as colleagues and do share information with each other.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been really lucky. So I've had mentors and advisors through grad school who have been very helpful, and they treat me with great respect, like colleagues, and we've been great friends. Yeah.
How did you find out about the human factors field?
How did I find out? Oh, boy. You know, like many people in the human factors world, I came to human factors through a really convoluted path. And it's actually a personal story. My father had an aneurysm and was in a coma for a couple of weeks. This is when I was just graduating from undergraduate, and I had plans to continue graduate work in the field of chemistry, of all things. And I was going to leave the country. I was going to go to Melbourne for my graduate work. But before I left, my father had an aneurysm, was in a coma, had to be operated on. And we thought he was, you know, we thought he was gone for sure. But he did recover, and a lot of what happened, we think, is from the rehab that he received. And so at that time, I decided, okay, rehab medicine is a good thing. Saved my father's life because now he's good as new. Good as new. It's amazing. It's like a miracle. Well, I don't believe in miracles, but it's amazing. However, okay, so at that point, I decided that I would want to do rehab medicine, and at Simon Fraser University, where I went to school for my undergraduate, they have a motor control program in kinesiology, and that's the closest I could find to rehab medicine. And at that time, I started studying motor control because I was interested in how people with Parkinson's and with Down syndrome control their movements so that they could be rehabilitated to, you know, do their normal daily motor tasks. And that's how I discovered ergonomics and occupational science. And from there, I discovered this field called human factors and ergonomics. Excuse me. So that's how it started. Through a really long, long route. And when I started, I actually was looking at how people manipulate remotely. And that was in the early 1990s when laparoscopic surgery was new in North America. And that was a special case of manipulation or remote manipulation. And people didn't really know very much about that area or how to design tools to allow the surgeons to do surgery remotely. So that's how I started.
Can you tell me what kind of work do you do now?
Oh, that's all about minimally invasive surgery. So I do research as well as teach at Tufts University. My research area has to do with human factors in medical systems and specifically minimally invasive surgery. Traditionally when surgeons perform surgery, they cut open the patient so that they can access the surgical site. But with technology, they can now do surgery remotely, leaving the patient with a very, very small scar and sometimes no scar, no visible scars. And the patient recovers faster with less trauma and less pain and suffering. But it's difficult for the surgeon to be performing surgery remotely as though they're playing video games. And the difficulty often results in inadvertent injuries, adverse events, and that affects patient outcome. So my work is really to look at design of technology, instruments, and training tools to allow them to perform better, to improve their performance, and ultimately to improve patient safety.
Do you have any favorite stories from your work life?
Oh, I have so many stories, but I don't know whether I have a favorite one. One of the ones that I can tell you about, because the technology or the company that produces technology is no longer around, we were working with a robotic system for laparoscopic surgery, and we thought this was the best piece of technology ever invented. And, you know, like most engineers, you think that the technology is supposed to improve work and help people with whatever it is they're doing. But the lesson we learned from that particular case was that, you know, before implementing new technology, there are issues related to human factors that you don't normally imagine would exist until you test it. So our first test of the robot in the OR revealed so many different problems with the technology itself and with the implementation. You know, it had to do with a new piece of equipment coming into the OR, the nurses and the doctor, the surgeon who was doing the operation had been trained separately on this piece of equipment but had never been trained together. So the team did not function well. Not only did they have to deal with the new piece of technology. They also had to deal with, you know, controlling the technology and coordinating the teamwork, which is completely separate from the surgical tasks themselves. I mean, can you imagine having to drive the robot on top of performing surgery? And so there were a lot of issues. And you know, I was happy that we were there during the first clinical trial with a real patient and being able to work on that. I think that's my favorite story.
So were you a success? Did it work?
Yeah, the technology itself, the robot itself, is actually very well designed. It's the implementation that didn't work. And so we were able to conduct some studies and show what could be improved. However, the company ran out of money, and so so no longer exists, which is too bad, which is really too bad.
Who's been the biggest influence on your career?
There are several people who have influenced me, and I think they're my mentors. They were my graduate advisors. I was lucky to have very good graduate advisors throughout my grad school education. And there are other people also who were instrumental in helping me make decisions about the direction of my career. And I've learned lessons from them, both directly and indirectly. So I've learned things about research, how to do research, how to keep an open mind, and explore different options. And also I've learned other lessons, which seem contradictory, but the lesson of being able to focus on the important things. So those lessons are very important for a successful research career, and I've learned them directly and indirectly from these people. These people are Christine McKenzie, Paul Milgram, Kim Vicente, Matt Weinger. These are my mentors.
Is there anything that you would love to do in your career, an opportunity that you would like?
That I don't have yet, you mean?
Yes. Your dream.
My dream. My dream and my goal are to do exactly what I'm doing now, but bigger. I love my job. I love teaching. I love doing research. If I could continue to do this for the rest of my life, I would be ecstatic. I would be so, so happy.
Well, that's something we both have in common.
Yeah, yeah. We love our jobs. And you know, there's nothing that can replace these. Oh, you know, I saw a question. What is the saddest thing that you've experienced in your work?
The saddest thing would always be injuries to children. It is so hard for me to work on those cases where one case, a grandparent put some acid on a top shelf and didn't put the lid on, and he was watching a grandchild and it spilled down him, and I'm looking at these horrific pictures where he had his ear burned off and burns to his body, and often they'll send me the photos. I don't really need the photos for my evaluation. Sometimes they come in the file, and they're just, anything involving a child is so hard for me to look at and so devastating, and you know those accidents could have been prevented.
Wow, yeah. Okay, what about your happiest moments?
There's so many happy ones.
Yeah.
Just
okay.
The opportunities to, I think my work's so exciting. So many opportunities to go to places I would ordinarily never get to go. And the back areas where I get special access so I could do my testing or evaluations. And I love to see how things work. And so I get to find out from the inside how everything works and meet fascinating people and travel and...
Yeah.
So there's so many upsides. I think the only real downside to my job is the stress.
Oh, the
Being
stress.
Being cross-examined for a living can be very stressful. What would you say is the happiest part of your work?
Oh, my happiest part of my work. There are so many. I can remember, well, I can name two off the top of my head, and one is seeing my graduate students do very well after they graduate. You know, most of my students, I've had about 20 graduate students so far in my teaching career, and most of them have landed very, very good jobs in industry. So that's something that makes me very, very happy. I think the other thing that makes me happy is seeing my work published.
I love seeing that too.
Yeah.
You see a chapter in a book, and
right.
The pictures. I often will put my children in the pictures, so book chapters, so that they're eternity.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we do research. We do research so that people know the work that we've done, so that they could make use of what we learn in their work, so that it benefits them. So that makes me happy.
Yeah, it makes me feel like something's living on past me.
And exactly.
That maybe if I could just save one life, or
right.
one accident, or one injury,
yeah.
it will all have been worth it.
Yeah, in some way, we are contributing to other, you know, to society, to making other people's lives easier, better.
Safer.
That's the bottom line, isn't it? Yeah. Other questions?
What would you change from your career if you could wave a magic wand? Would there be one thing that you would like to change?
About my career? I wouldn't change the path itself. What I would like to change if I had a magic wand is to eliminate the part of having to get grant money in order to do research. You know, when I imagine doing research as a career, I never imagined that I'd spend most of my time writing grant proposals. It's a necessary evil. I mean, the climate of research in this area is such that we spend a lot of time and effort and energy writing grant proposals when we really should be doing the research. So if I could change anything, I would eliminate the need for writing grant proposals and just, you know, have the resources and the support to do the research. What about you?
Wow. If I could have a magic wand, somehow I would learn to manage all the different balls that I have up in the air and not be stressful and be able to commingle running a company and having two adolescents and everything else all at the same time.
Oh, I can't imagine how you do that, how you juggle these two things.
It's a challenge sometimes to take care of all their events and all their homework and all the demands of all your clients, because when you are a consultant and you have multiple clients, I think the magic wand is to let them all know that, yes, they're all important, but not every single one of them is not my number one priority.
Right.
And actually none of them are, because my children are my number one priority.
Okay.
And yet each of them always thinks that they're number one and I need to change my schedule to accommodate their needs. And that can be extremely stressful when they're all demanding my time at the same time and trying to convince me they're more important than whoever else might be on that particular day.
Do you feel like you have to sacrifice any one of those things?
I sacrifice probably my free time.
Yeah.
I don't have a whole lot of it.
Yeah.
They'll say, well, okay, well, how are you for Saturday then?
Mm.
Can you do it Sunday afternoon? How about evenings?
Mm.
And I just think that that's really intrusive. That's my time with my family, and I try not to ever schedule that unless it's my lack of availability, because often I'll have a slot during the week, but they don't like it, and then they start to demand Sunday afternoons, and that really is not available. But when you're a consultant, they think if they retain you, they own you a lot of time.
Right.
And so that's where my magic wand would wave.
Yeah, if we could do that for everything, that would be nice. Done? Okay.